Nobody can follow. Not only Jesus, the Krishnamurti or Jesus Christ or whatever it is. Because in following you destroy their teachings. You cannot follow anybody and still practice his teachings. These two things cannot go together. Because when you follow, you have your eyes closed. You're looking at something else.
You're trying to do something that somebody else has done.
No, even that you don't do. You are looking at somebody else and therefore you are blind to yourself. What is happening within you, what's going on. And so when you are following someone, you can never practice somebody's teachings. And if you are interested in the teachings and you stop even to reflect, am I doing this correctly or not, that man is gone. Psychologically and physically, if he is a wanderer, he has moved on from that place to another place. And therefore we can only do either of these. Either you follow somebody's teachings or you follow him like a shadow. Like a shadow in the shadow. Andrew will be interested in that also. Krishnamurti. I'm not even sure what is meant by comparison. Either I am looking at you or at myself. I understand what is meant by comparison. You can only compare one static object with another static object. Or one insentient object with another insentient object. You can compare this microphone with another microphone. You can compare this lamp with another lamp. But you cannot compare one living entity with another living entity. By the time you have sized up this living entity and turned your attention on to that living entity, or even it may be yourself, you have first to size up that living entity and then say this is this is undergone a change in the meantime.
For instance, in the books that tell us about people who apparently are a lot clearer, say, the way the saints or whatever, and then it gives you examples of how he did this and she did that, and etc. And then you compare it to what you're doing, don't you? You say,
terribly immature. Terribly immature way. It's a beautiful saying in Tamil. It's a small poem. Kana mailara kandirinda vangoli thanandal ponla chirahai virittadinal podume kalladan katrakavi. There was a little hen, ordinary hen, hobbling around the backyard when a peacock happened to also descend upon that yard. Then there was cloud formations and so on, and the peacock was in ecstasy, and so it spread out its feathers and started dancing. And this little hen saw that, oh, I can also, I've got also wings. I can also spread out my wings and dance. Who is going to look at that? What a funny comparison. So you can go through the motions of the enlightened person. Like this little hen going through the motions of the peacock's dance. But that is something, and this is something quite different. And yet that's, you are right, that's what we do all the time. We look at someone's external behavior, which is the only thing that we can observe. And imitate him to the best of our ability. And what is even more interesting, I believe that in the case of diamonds, some of the artificial diamonds are even more glittering and more sparkling than the real ones. And in the same way, it is possible that the imitation yogi is more inspiring than the non-imitation yogi, for a very valid reason. I saw this in the case of Swami Shivananda, and in comparison with the others, the imitation ones. The imitation ones have a definite pattern and a definite motive. And a definite, and therefore they can strictly adhere to that pattern, knowing that this is going to impress people. Whereas the real yogi, he is not concerned with your appreciation or depreciation, and so he is natural, as a yogi should be. So the imitation yogi is even more greatly admired than the real one. But he is still imitation. It's imitation stuff. If you are able, if you have the proper instruments with which to evaluate, you can instantly discover that this is a rotten diamond. It's worth 10 cents. That's right. That is, you read. No. Wait. That's not imitation. No. There is a slight difference there. That is, you listen to their teaching, to the teachings concerning an enlightened person. An enlightened person does not lose his temper. Let's say, an enlightened person is always loving, always calm, has no jealousy. And even though you deem these things are there, you don't allow them to express themselves. You are angry within yourself, but you say, no, I am an enlightened person, I won't become angry. A double life, correct? So, as you go on doing this, if you are following that principle, not merely vulgarly imitating an enlightened person, you will very soon discover that these things are there and I am pretending to be otherwise. And you, as you go on in the living in this fashion, your own inner defects, as if they could be called so, become more and more observable. And you can get rid of them, by and by. In the meantime, society is benefited by it. Then you are not looking within yourself. Gain a greater insight into what goes on, that's perfectly all right. That is what I would call experimenting in saintliness, though some people don't like it. experimenting in saintliness. What does it feel like? What are the difficulties? Can I live like that? Correct.
There must be some similarity for you to make a
comparison. The similarity is exactly as you said, that we are both human beings. And then, from there on, as Satya said, it depends upon which track you follow, which road you follow. We are both human beings, and then suddenly you you become aware of the fact that the other person is admired by people. He has a great following. People look up to him and that sort of thing. And those are the things that attract you to saintliness. And therefore, you suggest to yourself, if I can also behave like him, I can also enjoy those privileges and public adoration and so on. Already you have lost the whole thing. You are not comparing yourself with his self. You are comparing the way he is treated by others with the way you think you are treated by others. You don't like the way you are being treated by others. You somehow like the way that he is treated by others. You like that. And so can I imitate, try to behave like him, and get into that lifestyle? That is when we begin to imitate. And that's not a very satisfactory approach at all. Possible. Oh, yeah, okay, I mean, if you realize that the qualities that are present in the saint are also latent in you and that they should somehow be developed, oh, that's a very good idea. That is what I told Satya, that if at that point you begin to imitate the saint, thinking that these qualities are there in me, all that it needs is a little bit of fanning and they will come up. Then it is possible that by the very imitation process, you might learn how to fan the fire. Or you might discover that they were not there at all. And you get more and more terrible. But in order to do that, you must learn to be more and more aware of yourself, and that is yoga, that's finished. It doesn't matter what the initial motivation is. Whatever be the initial motivation, if what you do turns your attention upon awareness upon itself, that's, you have done it. That is the famous story of the thief who went in to rob a king, and thought that he would become the king's son-in-law. He pretended to be a saint, and then eventually became a saint. Why not? Even in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a suggestion that if your renunciation is based upon fear of suffering, and I don't want this, and it's a very terrible thing, I would like to renounce it. It's not the proper motivation for renunciation. I've seen this in the case of at least one person who became a Swami because his wife was unfaithful to him. That's all. It's a terrible thing, and they ran away from the house, came to Rishikesh. But unfortunately for him, he didn't utilize that opportunity to look within and see whether in him there was really a spirit of renunciation or whether there was just a hurt. So that a few years later, when some other woman came and said, I adore you, he was run away. Whatever be the initial motivation, if as you go on, you are hurt, yes, sure, you are hurt. So you abandon that situation, go away. But as you go on, if you begin to look within, to see that the wife's unfaithfulness need not have hurt me. Hey, why does it hurt me? You got onto the right track, regardless of the initial momentum. So whatever happens, whether your idea is to imitate, whether your idea is to abandon the world because it is miserable, or life is difficult, or you don't want all the responsibility, or you don't want to work, do an honest day's work and earn something, why not put on a nice orange robe and call myself a Swami? I can pay my fare. That sort of thing. And in this imitation, you are not worried at all about what goes on within you, but you are more concerned with how many people you have taken in. Then you have lost an opportunity. There are very few people in the world today who are so full of that wisdom which inspired a Buddha to seek enlightenment. They're not, unfortunately or fortunately, there are not too many Buddhas in this world. Even they who renounce the world have some sort of chip on their shoulders. But that doesn't matter. Carry, go on. You know, you've read the story of Dhruva, who was taunted by his stepmother and so went to the forest. And it is said that Narayana stood in front of him and said, what do you want? This story is not according to Bhagavatam, some other text. And he says, nothing. I don't want anything. And there is a very beautiful verse. Thana bilashi tapasistutoham. The next bit I have forgotten. Kachin vichinban muda aparatnam is the third. And fourth again I have forgotten. The sense being, he says, Lord, I remember why I came here. I was denied the privilege of sitting on the throne, and so hurt by that, I came here to adore you. Now that I have seen you, I don't want the throne anymore. And this little boy gives an illustration. A man goes to the beach collecting shells, and suddenly he finds a pearl. Why would he continue to look for shells anymore? So, is that possible? You are looking for a way of avoiding the situation which hurt you. You run away from that situation. And you have no other motivation, you have no enlightenment idea, nothing. But having gone away from that situation because of the hurt, you have a chance of reflecting and coming to a clear understanding that this is not an isolated incident, but this is the nature of the world. It is not that my wife was unfaithful to me, but unfaithfulness is the nature of the world. Regardless of all this husband-wife relationship, these bodies are going to be unfaithful to me. I clean it, I bathe it, I feed it, and I groom it every day, and it's going to kick me out one of these days. So, if that understanding arises at some stage, then that even that hypocritical renunciation is not wasted. If similarly your imitation leads to some sort of self-understanding, not self-knowledge in the highest sense of the word, of a self-understanding, then that imitation is not wasted. If the imitation is motivated otherwise, that I want to be as prominent as the other person, as famous as the other person, then your awareness is not focused on yourself. Naturally, there is no enlightenment. There's nothing, it's wasted. Then you are neither yourself, nor are you ever going to be the other person. And you fall between two stools.
Send Mary in, and Mary's just sitting at Jesus' feet. And he says, no, no, she's doing the right thing. That's how I do
it. That was probably said in a very different sense.
Mm.
That she has found God. Why should she follow God?
It didn't have any context around it.
Is the context. I think the... Hamsa is the authority here. She has chosen the better path. That is, if you are in the company of God, why do you want to do japa?
No, but she was preparing his dinner.
That one. Poor thing.
She was in the kitchen.
Yeah, that was her job. She chose that job. Yeah, you are right. That has puzzled many people. But the idea here being, it is not a question of following a master or worshipping a master. You don't worship a master and get salvation. But here, there is a hint whether Jesus really meant it or not, that she has found her goal. Let's go back to this Dhruva. Forget this. I mean, it may hurt other people. This Mary Martha controversy. Let's go back to this Dhruva. He was meditating with closed eyes on Vishnu and repeating Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And Narayana or Vishnu stands in front of him. Why would he go on saying Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya? You are here. As Ramana Maharshi has often pointed out, you go on seeking self-realization. But when that is clear, when the answer is clear, why will you go on seeking again? The illustration he gives was, you ask, where is Ramanashram, where is Ramana Maharshi? And they say here, they say there, go this way, go that way. once you have entered the hall where Ramana Maharshi used to sit, and you are in Ramana Maharshi's presence, you don't go and ask him, where is Ramana Maharshi? He's here. That's it. No. Unless you believe that that is the presence, the divine presence, that Jesus is divine, the meaning will not be clear.
So,
she has reached the goal. Mm-hmm. That's all.
So getting back to the other thing, are following the teachings and following the...
Following the teaching in order to reach God. And after having reached God, what, whose teaching are you going to follow? This is said in regard to gurus and teachers and so on, not in regard to God.
But then I misunderstood because I considered Jesus in that context.
That's a different, that's it. If you regard Jesus as God, there is no problem. That means your ego is completely gone. Can you do that? That's whatever her name is, Mary, is it? Yeah. Can you become totally absorbed in the divine? In which case, again, there is absolutely no following a teaching. As a matter of fact, you are right, even that way. The people who were close to Swami Shivananda had hardly time to follow his teachings. And strangely enough, or not so strangely enough, if we obeyed him 100%, we disobeyed the printed teachings. The printed sheet says, get up at 4 a.m., do japa. And he gives you so much work that you can't go to bed till 4 o'clock. Then what do? You can't get up at 4 o'clock. And then he himself says, no. And he says, don't take tea or coffee. Another instruction. And Swami Omkarananda and I used to work till late at night. And one day he came and sat there and made somebody go and prepare a thermos flask full of coffee and some upma, brought it to us, and made us eat there in front of him and then went. Yeah. Violation of the 15th commandment. There you can cite this Mary and Martha example. You are here, what do you want to do? So, but as Shanti said, if you can completely face yourself, which means the seeker is not there at all. There is no seeker anymore. There is no sadhaka anymore. You are dead. What teachings are to be followed now? Nothing. That's a different path altogether. Path of complete and total surrender. And you feel you are in the presence of God. It's quite possible. If, I hope this interpretation is correct, if it is not, Hamsa will correct me. If, who was the woman in the kitchen?
Martha.
If Martha also had this attitude, that Christ is here and he has asked me to prepare his lunch. That's it. She is not worried at all about what the other woman is doing. And you will do it with the greatest of pleasure. Omkarananda and I, we didn't bother what the others were doing, whether they were sleeping or meditating or whatever it is. This is what Swami Shivananda has asked us to do. It's enough. No more question. God has asked us to do this and them to do something different. That's it. So you struggle. where there is complete surrender, then it doesn't, whether you are meditating or working or following the teachings, well, that is the teaching. Surrender is the greatest teaching. But that's, again, theoretical. But I have a feeling that, strangely enough, there has been a very big change within these 20 or 30 years. I've seen it in my own eyes. It's not, it is not even a subtle change. It's not even a change which one has to observe keenly. During the past 20 or 30 years, 30 years, let's say, there's been such a drastic change that that attitude is completely gone. The attitude of surrender to the Guru and devotion to the Guru is completely gone. I'm seeing it even in the ashrams and things like that in India. If you had gone, not only our ashram, I could safely say most of the ashrams in or around Rishikesh, Uttarkashi, and those areas. And perhaps, I'm guessing, that was the case even in the Christian communities. There is a certain loyalty, there is a certain loving obedience. Not obedience in the sense of obeying a master. Loving obedience, devotion, that thing is almost completely gone. Whether it is due to some kind of atomic fallout or psychological fallout, I don't know. And only if you appreciate that, probably you can also appreciate why Krishnamurti has been going on saying, don't follow the Guru blindly. There was a time when the Guru was being followed blindly, not now. And that time was not mythical or legendary, hearsay. I've seen this, I've seen it. I've seen it done, I've seen it practiced, I've seen it that it was possible. It is possible blindly to follow the Guru, it is possible to follow the Guru in an enlightened way. But now it's disappeared. Not during my travels for the past 20 years. And unless you have seen that, you wouldn't know, you wouldn't recognize. You might go to an ashram today and see that so-and-so is bowing down to so-and-so and so-and-so is doing implicitly what the Guru says, but that's, the quality is not there. Something which was there is not there. Why is it so? I don't know. Some cosmic change taking place. And that is why once I even suggested to Krishnamurti himself that you are saying people should not follow another. I tell you, people don't follow another. You don't have to say it. Nobody followed. He just laughed and kept quiet. It's not so easy.